The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Vint cannot remember exact dates from 60 years ago. At deposition, he would likely have to say, I can't recall. Bob starts his hacking career at 9 years old with cotton balls, a child's toy, and a wire hanger. Or is that a hanger? More on Cognitive Defense's free webinar, an update from old friends, more fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Enlighten your way ahead. Executives, understand where you are going, why, and how to get there, make better decisions through independent expert advice, and understand how the world is changing. Knights of the Realm, bring prosperity to you and your enterprise, realize the pitfalls you face and how to avoid them, and expand your influence and alternatives. Independents, stay ahead of the curve to understand your future, better serve your customers to expand your situation, and improve your skills and the world as it changes. Enlighten, your way ahead. At ELN3.com.
This segment's called The Pitch. In The Pitch, a company presents in the hopes that you, the listening audience, will find them interesting enough to go the next step.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant Wednesday to you, wherever you may be.
Sandy into his windup. Here's The Pitch.
Hi, I'm Marcus Suri, founder and CEO of OD Vision, Inc., makers of Tricorder Zero, the tricorder for telehealth and fitness. To our knowledge, Tricorder Zero will be the first ever fully integrated seven-sensor health and fitness device that enables the full potential of telehealth and telefitness. We've been seen in numerous publications, and we're solving two problems. First, 30 million Americans have no health insurance, and 40% of Americans can't afford to see their doctors. Well, the first solution is the device itself. It's a seven-sensor health and fitness tracker that will allow people to track their health and fitness without the need of a doctor. There's a high magnification camera for the outer eye and skin, a retractable camera for the ear, nose, and throat, an IR thermometer, a pulse oximeter, a body fat and muscle tone sensor, a stethoscope, and an EKG. Other problem is that telehealth is currently just a FaceTime call that limits patients' quality of care. Physicians don't have enough insight when limited to a patient's subjective complaints, so they're limited in prescribing drugs, ordering tests, and or referring to specialists. The missing objective sensor data means that patients are often asked to come into the office for a full evaluation, which is wasting billions of dollars each year. Initial primary care telehealth visits have a higher rate of in-office follow-up than initial in-office visits because only 18% of all telehealth augments the audio call with medical equipment, and 4% of calls have equipment automatically sending data to providers. The second solution is using Tricorder Zero with its white-labeled and in-house telehealth platform along with the device itself. Independent practitioners can increase the efficiency and profits via holistic telehealth as triage. Insurance companies can increase profits by optimizing prevention and early detection and reducing payouts. And hospital systems increase profits by maximizing high-value ER visits and hospital admissions. We have numerous concepts patent pending, and we've also recently been provided a patent for AI-assisted touchless blood pressure determination. So we've already proved demand for the device by collecting emails from ads that we send out on social media. It costs us about $3 to get an email, and we are planning to collect 100,000 emails based on this funding round of $300,000 we're already raising on WeFunder. And that will allow us to collect 5,000 orders on our eventual Kickstarter campaign. That means a $60 marketing cost with a $40 profit per $300 device. So the market has already validated this concept. TidoCare as a device, MayaMD as an AI symptom diagnosis engine, and MD Live as a multi-specialty telehealth app combined still don't provide all of the features of Tricorder Zero, but they get close and they all have many users. So the market opportunity here is huge. The 2028 total worldwide connected telehealth market will be $1 trillion. And we believe we can have a 25% global market share. So we've accomplished a lot in our timeline in the past couple of years. We went from design progression to 3D modeling to a breadboard, transitioning to a device prototype, programming our app prototype, and then getting the device and app prototype working together. As I mentioned, we have 12 plus patents pending, a design patent, as well as the first touchless blood pressure determination patent. We had completed our app shell, completed our sensor programming, our device and app programming. We even completed a venture accelerator program in March of 2023 and have completed our ad testing as well. So here's some information about me. I have made a concerted effort to obtain education, certifications, and skills very relevant to the exact startup that I'm heading at the moment. And I hope you'll agree with that. And more importantly, or equally importantly, I have advisors who have very deep domain expertise in their various fields. So our business model is essentially a B2B and B2C hybrid. What we're attempting to do is have a Kickstarter campaign to collect orders and then use that as validation to allow us to get larger orders from our real customers, which will be insurance companies. So when we prove to the insurance companies that the end user is actually paying out of their own pocket for a device that the insurance company should be providing to them at no cost because it benefits the insurance company to the tune of billions of dollars, we believe the insurance companies will be placing large orders with us going forward. So we have numerous exit options. We could have an IPO, sale to big tech, pharmacy, big insurers, hospital conglomerates, medical device companies, or just sale or license our IP. So we've raised $457,000 previously. We're raising $300,000 currently for ads for our $1.5 million Kickstarter campaign. We're raising that on WeFunder. So far, out of our tens of investors, I believe we have over 60 investors now, we have 17 physician investors, numerous repeat investors, investors from seven countries, and two of our WeFunder investors have already doubled their investment during the campaign. And we've already raised over $83,000. So the train is moving, and let's go on this journey together. Thank you for your time.
Matlack on the 0-1. Bobby hits a drive into the gap in the left center field. There she is. For a double. Everybody standing.
Just a short note for those not yet steeped in the lingo of the investment world. WeFunder is an online service that allows individual investors to crowdfund startup companies. WeFunder uses a provision in the 2012 Jobs Act that allows unaccredited investors to purchase equity in early-stage private companies. Kickstarter is an American public benefit corporation based in Brooklyn, New York, that maintains a global crowdfunding platform focused on creativity. The company's stated mission is to help bring creative projects to life.
For more details on this pitch and to view their gee whiz, go to thecybershow.co and click on their listing.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on the Cyber Show. Hot mics are getting hotter, as every politician can now tell you. But the newest attack involves using AI-generated voice to fake the content of the hot mic. All you do is take some garbled part of the hot mic recording when they are not facing camera and overwrite it with your simulated voice content. And that's breaking news on the Cyber Show. How do we know we're being successful at the Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. 1. We know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. 2. We know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. 3. We know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. 4. We know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And 5. We know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think,
You can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions, and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show, only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening. Cognitive Defense is an emerging company helping other companies defend against malicious influence operations. They do this by helping people better defend themselves against exploitation. You can get in touch with Cognitive Defense by going to cogdef.com. That's cogdef.com, or find them through their link at thecybershow.co. Frauds, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. When I graduated from college, I got a job in Texas, and while driving on the way to my new job from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where I lived previously, I encountered a small fare off the side of the road. I decided to take a break and have some fun. While walking through the fair that day, I encountered a place where they were betting that I could not guess something or another about cards taken from a standard deck. I did a quick calculation of the odds in my head and determined that I would be able to win if I remembered correctly. So I took them up on it. After three tries at $20 a pop, I got the right answer and should have won $100, but then they changed the rules on me. So I demanded my $100 and they simply refused. I should have found a policeman and reported them, but being young and dumb, they offered me my last $20 back, and I took it and decided not to take them on. They looked bigger than me, frankly, and there were a lot of them. Of course, in this case, the big mistake I made was in trying to gamble at such a place. Clearly, when you play a game with professionals, you need to be prepared to lose, and when you play it in an uncontrolled setting, you need to really be prepared to be defrauded. Forward to the modern era, where crime is largely online because of the efficiency of the automated crime process, the ability to scale, and of course the reduced chance of ever being caught, and we have the online gambling business. Now, I do not mean to say that all online gambling is a fraud, but considering that they get to write the software and you put up the money, they can make you win or lose at any time and can exploit your psychological tendencies to get you to keep losing more and more to them, I'd say it's a good bet. All right, I shouldn't even say it. Unlike the obvious tricks people play with physical cards, there's just no way to tell what my computer somewhere else in the world is doing from your position at your computer terminal. While betting on a horse race or football game at least has an actual outcome you can compare yourself to, the odds are supposed to be set by the pool of bets on each side, as they are at the track. Online, the number of people betting on each side at any given point spread are not really known by you or particularly controlled by any authority. The odds of them getting caught if they cheat are nearly zero, and why shouldn't they? If this doesn't sound familiar, it should. The issue is where you go. At least in Vegas, you know that when you're betting at a table full of cards, that they're almost certainly not cheating. And you know that the one-armed bandits that are, of course, going to take your money on the average, are at least monitored and controlled by the government. But online gambling, for the most part, is uncontrolled, out of control, and if it was controlled, how would you know that you were using the controlled one? So for online gambling, I would say, no, don't walk away, run away, quickly. Just don't go there. Every week we'll feature another cyber fraud to help keep you aware of what's going on and what you can do about it. If you'd like to read the book, Fraud, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them, it's available online at all.net under books. That's ALL.NET, and you press on books. This segment is called, How Do They Do That? While threat actors already know how, many executives don't believe it's possible. We explain it so even a CEO can understand it. This is one of those cases where doing these sorts of crimes is a little bit more complicated. There are a couple things involved. The first step is getting some email address that's not particularly attached to or accountable to you. That's pretty easy. You can go out and get a Gmail address, but you might actually have to do something to authenticate yourself to someone somewhere. There are plenty of other email services where you can just, you know, from a library, go get an email account with no attribution to who it is or where it is. It just came from a library. If you're a little more sophisticated, you're leasing room on other people's computers, so you just use one of those computers that you've broken into one way or the other through that that business that is the new cybercrime business. The vertical businesses allow you to get accounts on other people's computers and so forth. Use one of those accounts, and to do that, you know, you just create a new Gmail account using the previous account that you had from buying it from somebody, and off you go. And of course, You wouldn't just want one. You want to get, you know, 20 or 30 per day or per week. It's not that hard to sign up for them. Once you have that email account, now you have leverage to get things like websites. So websites can be gotten for almost nothing or nothing. There are various providers that will give you a website if you have an email address. You sign up to their free service, and then you get a website. Now from the website, the next thing you have to do is create the gambling site. So creating the gambling site, not exactly hard to do. You copy something from another gambling site, legitimate or not, it doesn't matter. You just copy it by downloading it with something like, it's a tool called WGET or WebGET or something like that. Or there are other tools that allow you to duplicate websites. You can also do it directly through your browser if you're just a little bit sophisticated. You copy that stuff onto the website, and now you have your own copy of the gambling site, except, of course, it points, you know, to the other guy's gambling. So any advertising you do is going to be advertising for them. So the next step, you have to create some sort of a backend to simulate the gambling process. This is not hard to do. You write programs to do this. Of course, because of the criminal enterprises out there, you can simply lease somebody else's time to do it, and they'll create you one. Or you can go to a so-called legitimate service and pay them. It's not very expensive to have them create websites or other similar presents for you. Once you have the website created with that gambling process, you need to take money. So taking money requires a bank account, but in today's world, you can use Bitcoin instead. So you can create a Bitcoin account or some other cryptocurrency account so they can gamble with cryptocurrency. You can go to an exchange to allow them to buy cryptocurrency through the exchange. Those are semi-legitimate. In many cases, they're almost nearly really, well, they're semi-legitimate. Some of them are not legitimate at all, but mostly they're semi-legitimate. So now that you have a way to take their money, you start to advertise. Oh, did I mention the gambling site has to make it look like they won or lost something? So every once in a while, they have to win, and you accumulate a toll, you know, that says, oh, you've won this much. And when you want to take your money out, you say, are you sure? And you make them go through 18 or 20 steps. And you might not ever give them their money back, but if you want to, that's fine. It's no problem. Through those, you know, my financial sites, you can do that. So now that they're in the site, you start advertising. So how do you start advertising? Well, an email campaign is pretty good, where you go into social media and you, you know, go into various other groups with your email accounts. You join groups. In fact, while you're at it, you can like yourself and your other identities, so you can become more and more apparently popular. And the more apparently popular you are, the more people will see what you do, and the more people will add themselves to your lists. You point them to the websites so they can go gambling. And of course, with some of your fictitious IDs, you claim, oh man, I won a lot of money, completely legitimate, and all these things. So you just run that scam for as long as you run it. And eventually, you know, people start to catch on and complain, and you just walk away from it. Don't bother to log in from those phony IDs. Don't bother to use those sites. Take your Bitcoin out. You've done this along the way, presumably. So you're walking away with however much cash, and you're basically good to go. So that's the basics of how it works. You know, it takes a little bit of technical skills and training, but you can also learn that because there are online sites that will teach you. No problem. And that's how you do that.
Enlighten your way ahead. Executives can understand where you're going, why, and how to get there, make better decisions through independent expert advice, and understand how the world is changing. Knights of the Realm, you can bring prosperity to you and your enterprise, realize the pitfalls you face and how to avoid them, and expand your influence and alternatives. Independents can stay ahead of the curve to understand your future, better serve your customers to expand their situation, and improve your skills and the world as it changes. Enlighten your way ahead at ELN3.com.
In this segment, we're going to talk to Bob Monroe. Bob has a long history of being a hacker of one form or another, always in a legitimate way, always doing things in order to get the job done, so to speak. And of course, after he got out of his previous career, he started to work with Hacker High School to develop lessons that real people could understand. So when it comes to teaching people about cybersecurity and issues related to it, Bob is really outstanding. Here's Bob.
Laptop on 2 hours ahead of time, make sure the video works, make sure the camera, audio, everything works. And of course, 5 minutes before the call starts, Windows wants to do an update.
So I'm here with Bob Monroe, who I guess I met him through Hacker High School, but we're going to start a lot earlier in your life. And so let's start with where you're born, where you grew up, and when you first encountered anything cyber in your life.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Fred. I appreciate you. having me on the show, and I appreciate your audience for them giving me.
Yeah, by the way, that's the kind of stuff we cut.
All right. Let's see. I was born in Southern California, outside of Whittier, a little town called La Habra. Yeah, it's where all the boulevards end. Whittier Boulevard ends there. Harbor Boulevard ends there. All the boulevards end at this place.
Right. Just off the end of the road. That's where you were.
Exactly. Yeah. That's just, yeah. But now it's, of course, it's a thriving metropolis, I'm sure. But
maybe not. You'd be surprised. Of course, that was long ago. That must have been, what, in 1823 or something? Long, long time ago.
Yeah, when they were still panning for gold, yeah.
I still remember how that music used to make me smile.
So you grew up panning for gold in Southern California?
Oh, I wish. So I grew up in there wasn't a whole lot of opportunities where I was growing up. You know, I had the option of course, spending my life being manual labor. I didn't have money for college. I didn't exactly have great grades, and I made the mistake of telling my daughter that once. I told her I was a C average student, and she hasn't let that one go yet. So bad idea to tell your kids what your GPA was.
Well, especially because then they have low expectations, right?
True.
Yeah, you can't complain because they say, hey, you know, you didn't do any better than I'm doing. What's your problem?
Well, I tell them, look at the end product, though.
Yeah, and then they said, you know, because, you know, teenagers are revolting. I'm sorry. In the relationship between children and parents always goes further apart and closer together. And in the teen years, they have a tendency to get further apart. And just like this was from a Marie Antoinette takeoff, where she said the people are revolting. And she didn't mean it was a revolution. But moving right along, so you didn't get great grades in school, but cyber. When did you first encounter cyber?
There was a Radio Shack in town, and was able to scrape together enough money to buy this little 8-bit computer that you had to code in BASIC, and it had a little cassette. And the hardest thing was trying to buy cassettes, because you could only take certain, like, I think it was 30-minute cassettes. It wouldn't take 60-minute or 90-minute cassettes.
Yep. So this was a TRS-80, right?
I don't even know if it was probably a TRS-1.
TRS-80 was the first one, because it was an 8080 processor, right?
All I know is I found it very early on. I couldn't code. I'm not a coder.
Even in BASIC?
Yeah, even more so in BASIC. There was this game that you had to code, where you had this little artillery and you had to hit these little boxes and you had to program this thing, and I got no, it just errors.
So that's because you were intolerant of limited syntax.
No, because I was an extremely overactive kid.
Okay.
I'm a perfect example of what happens when you have an ADH kid that becomes an adult, and you can make a very successful life out of being an ADHD adult.
All right, now what does ADHD stand for? Because when we use initials on the show, you have to tell us what it means first time using.
Something about attention deficit, something or other, something or other.
Yeah, you can't pay attention long enough to get to the end of the acronym, but deficit something or other.
Something
all right,
like that.
So is that diagnosed or is that just your opinion of yourself?
Oh, no. No, it's not diagnosed. They didn't have it back then.
It wasn't real back then. It was just, well, he's an over-anxious, over-operant, whatever kid, right?
Yeah, he can't sit down to read. He can't sit down to do anything.
Yeah, you had ants in your pants.
Yeah, don't go to church with me. That was sitting in a pew for an hour.
Well, I don't think we can use the H word here. But so when you went to church, you would not or could not, or did you actually sit there for an hour and just frustrate your parents?
Yeah, I pretty much frustrate them to no end. So, but what?
They're proud of you now. So
I don't know. No, I'm just kidding. Yes, they very quite proud. But I hit about the middle of high school. And I was working several jobs at the time, everything from doing plastic fabrication to driving a 20-foot flatbed truck
So when you talk about fabrication, plastic fabrication, was that purely mechanical, or did that use some sort of machinery that had feedback systems in it?
No, it was kind of like welding. It's very much like soldering, where you have two pieces of polypropylene, basically sheets of plastic, polypropylene, and then you would heat up this filler, and you would use it in kind of like a caulk gun, and you would basically weld the two polypropylene pieces together. So fairly simple stuff.
Yeah. Well, there was some cyber probably in the heating element that kept it at the right temperature, but that wasn't what you were involved in. You were just involved with the make it stick together right.
Yeah, I didn't do anything with electronics. Well, I was proud of myself when I was a young lad. I couldn't afford headphones, so I built my own.
Oh, well, so tell me about that. How did you build it? When you got some speakers from Radio Shack and taped them to your ears, how did you do this?
No, worse. I got some children's toys from one of the thrift stores, and I pulled the speakers out of them. And they're these little metal circular discs about the shape of a quarter, about the size of a quarter. And I wired them up to, I think it was a coat hanger that I was able to put around my head. And because those little discs would hurt, I put cotton balls on them and did a wiring job to put it together. And it looked like...
But it worked, right?
It worked.
Okay, so that sounds like cyber to me. Okay, fantastic. All right, so and how old were you when you did that?
I was probably about 9 or 10.
I love it. Okay. So yeah, now we're to the reality of what it is to be you, because this is, I think that represents in no small amount a fundamental of your character and your being that has carried through for the rest of your life. But we're going to take a break here. Okay. Destined to manual labor, but makes hacker headphones.
Archimedes is so ADHD friendly, in fact, rich, that it's a cliche in itself. But you know, you think about this, you know, he had me thinking when I was a little tiny kid, you know, in Colorado in the late 60s, you know, and you know, discover how a screwdriver works, or you know, the wired telephones, you could unscrew the mouthpiece, you take it out, and there's, you know, the mouthpiece device in there, which is just held in by pressure to a couple metal contacts and comes out in your hand. And you know, to the stage, you know, where Bob's talking about here, you know, you're 9, 10 years old, and you're thinking, all right, you know, figure this out, right? And it's a wonderful thing, right? And we end up, you know, look, you know, we went from the post-industrial revolutionary world, which was, you know, sort of pseudo-chaotic. You know, people did what they did. You know, they're born, you know, lived in their communities and found a way to contribute to the industrial revolution, where we regimented, you know, mass production and so forth. You know, leading to the post-war era in the 20th century. And you know that you and I were born into, and yeah, that this very successful effort to average everything out, so you can get high productivity and high manufacturing and all the aspects of that. The thing is, where we are today in the cyber world, and particularly in cybersecurity, where those are good things, right? However, you know, sometimes you need folks like Bob.
So one of the things that pops into my head when I see these things, he's putting stuff together from parts, right? So in this industrialized world, you have all these parts that are, you know, part of things that were ridiculously inexpensive to make, made in mass quantity, are now part of the throwaway culture. And if you just go through the garbage, you can probably build anything you want, right? It's just, you know, what are you looking for? I need some headphones. Oh, look, there's a kiddie toy. It probably cost a dollar and a half. He bought it in a thrift mart, probably that was, you know, after somebody else threw it out, right? And a coat hanger. But it hurts my ears. So, okay, cotton balls. Done. You know?
Right. Like just having a 2x4 300 years ago, 500 years ago, you know, getting a board.
You couldn't hardly make one. It would be terribly difficult to get one.
Right, you know, the amount of effort as opposed to $2.38 at Home Depot, right? And
it
and
might be more expensive now, but
right, you know, scrap wood from construction sites. And when you were a kid, when I was a kid, you know, in the 70s and in the 80s, yeah, we built all sorts of forts and so forth. And you're right, you know, there's so many components just laying around loose in the world.
Yeah, just, I mean, look, it's still true today, right? So in the front of my house, you can't have your garbage can so other people can see it, so you have to build a fence around it. So we have a fence built around it and has these two swinging doors so the garbage cans can come in and out. And you go to open the door, and because of the way the hinges are, it'll go too far. And because it gets windy, when the door flips open, it'll fly over and it'll eventually break the door and mess everything up. So what happens, I have some 2x4s there. And I have an electric screwdriver, you know, a drill with an electric bit on, with a screwdriver bit on it, whatever. And some screws, right? Some whatever they all are, the name of the bloody screw, grabbers, you know, 2-3-inch grabbers. I just screw them in so that when the door opens, if it gets to the point where I want it to stop, it just hits the other piece of wood. Takes care of the problem, right? So just wood hanging around. So I have another piece of this wood, and I'm trying to figure out how you make a latch for the gate, because trying to make a latch when you have two gates that are attached to each other in the middle and nothing in the ground, you know, they'll swing freely. So how do you do that? Well, so I get a 2x4, just a chunk of 2x4 that's about 1 foot long. And you know, the way a fence is built, you have the flaps on the outside and you have a 2x4 behind it. So I just put, you know, another piece of wood on the other side of the 2x4 on each side. So I now have a 2x4 width on each side of the fence. And I just take the last 2x4 and just drop it in. And now the gate won't swing. Right. And so now I take the same grabber with my electric screwdriver, and I just, you know, screw into the side of that 2x4 that's now hanging between them. And now you just lift it up. It's like a latch, but it doesn't flop around because it's fitted to the 2x4 on top of the 2x4. So, you know, it's just everything in the world you put together like that. And here's Bob doing it at 9 years old with electrical equipment, who, you know, is growing up super poor, you know, basically from a thrift store, makes headphones. I love it.
Yeah, and leads to.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Vint Cerf is one of the best-known early internet ARPANET developers, researchers, and one of the folks that's considered by many as one of the founders of the internet as it exists. He has continued to work over many years for a variety of companies and doing a variety of different work related to forming networks. Here's Vint.
How you first encountered computers. You've told us you did something with them, but what's your first encounter with any cybernetic thing?
1958. I was visiting.
You know the actual year.
I even almost know the month, but the year.
Tell us.
It's probably sometime in the summer. I was at System.
So hang on, let me just check here. So the summer of 58.
Right.
Are you saying you can't remember the exact date and time of your first encounter with computers?
That's correct. I can't remember.
I better make a note here about your lapse of memory, your inability to remember simple questions. All right, continuing on. So your first encounter with computers.
What a dummy response that was. And that's not one of the seven words we're not allowed to say.
Which word are you not allowed to say that you said?
Dummy. That would be you.
I'm not sure if that's a word you're not allowed to say. We will probably replace it with dumb. Shh. So nobody will know.
Okay. Well, listen, you dumb beep. Let me finish. The System Development Corporation in Santa Monica had one of the many data centers that were part of the semi-automated ground environment, or SAGE system.
This is 1958.
Yes, yes. Now, SAGE was a 1950s development. They put distant early warning radars in the northern parts of Canada to track, Russian missile or Russian bombers coming over the pole.
And yeah, there weren't missiles yet at that point in time that could get there. Ballistic missiles yet.
No, they were. Yes, they did, because they were very close. Remember that they launched Sputnik on October 4th, 1957. And so there was already a threat. That was why Sputnik was such a big deal, because
a perceived threat.
Yes, a perceived threat. So anyway, so the distant early warning radars transmitted data back over telephone lines at 2400 bits a second to the SAGE systems, that, of which there were some dozen or so. One of them was a training facility at System Development Corporation. So this was a tube-based machine. And so I visited there. You literally walked into the computer in order to use it because the tube things were all lining the walls. It looked like Dr. Strangelove, except Strangelove didn't happen until 4 years later in 62. So that was my first encounter with a computer of any.
All right. So hey, just so we're sure here. So you didn't do anything with mechanical computers before that. It was just tubes is where you started.
It was just tubes. And
all
I
right,
did.
All right. So you're a Johnny come lately to computers. Okay. We're going to take a break and then we'll continue with the discussion.
Okay.
So, you know, we think of Vint as having been there in the early days, but he never programmed a mechanical computer. I mean, how early a day could that be for?
Well, you know, it's all relative. You know, the Joe Screwdriver's RetroTech time machine on Roku, for everybody out there, is this great, you know, compilation of old documentary films and short films and so forth. I love, you know, some of the military ones, the artillery computers on World War II ships, you know, the training film and how to use those, right? You know, the analog systems. So yeah, where did that?
It turns out my grandfather developed, designed, and implemented one of the early bomb sites for World War II, and you know, purely mechanical, optical, fascinating, you know, device with lots of controls and such. And it turns out the Norton site was the winner, but my grandfather developed one, so we had one in our basement when I was a kid.
Yeah, which you had to take out of the wreckage if you survived a crash in those planes. You know, one of those, that was one of the requirements. You know, you got to take that out and destroy it.
No, you have to destroy it if you're going to wreck. Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we used to sit in the basement and we'd look through this thing and do all these adjustments. And I didn't know what it was at the time until, you know, my mother explained it to me that it was, you know, her dad, you know, it was his bomb site. So this mechanical computer, you know, fascinating device, and the same that there were mechanical computers on the on ships that adjusted the firing of the guns for the roll of the ship and the wave motion, and then in tanks they had the same thing. So there were certainly mechanical computers in the 1940s for that sort of thing. So I think when we think about cybernetic systems and we notion about this being super ultra modern, you know, there's a long history of mechanical mechanisms that automated these sorts of cybernetic methods. And even I think going back to World War One, and, you know, in the early days of submarines, which was, I guess, like the U.S. Civil War, not the Civil War, the war for freedom against England, right? We had the first submarines.
The Revolution. Yes.
Yeah, right. The Revolution had the first submarines. And they also had these mechanical computers. Everything was not personally turning every valve. You know, there were things of the day. And then ship steering, right? There were automated, you know, ship steering mechanisms long ago. And even the sighting, you know, sighting by the stars, you know, those are mechanical devices for, you know, figuring out where you are and your path forward. And those existed, I think that's got to be at least it's not 1,000 years old probably, right? But certainly 500, like that.
Well, that Greek computer was like 2,500 years old, you know, with all the gears, the blanking on the name, but it is the oldest piece of calculating machinery, you know, used. But the you know, what fascinates me, you know, you might have all seen a headline late 2023 about 476,000 year old Lincoln logs, right? You know, basically two logs that were notched by hand to fit together, you know, to form a structure, you know, and this team out of Oxford found at a site in Africa. So you think about this, people like us, and this is actually pre-Homo sapiens, it was Homo erectus, most likely, right? Yeah, but basically people looking at things and making a structure and putting it together for a purpose, you know, changing the environment, putting it together in pieces. And to your point, and we still do it. It's basically the net, you know, of, you know, everyone.
Well, it is the big differentiator, right? There are other animals that do similar sorts of things to create their living environments. Human beings and the, you know, ancestors that we have before us from different Homo whatevers, you know, they also did this. And now you think about the evolution as we're starting to integrate electromechanical cybernetic devices into heads, into brains, and connect them up to people. That's, you know, the Borg, whatever. The next evolution of humanity, besides the evolution of the physicality of human beings, is the integration of that with the automation. And, you know, where we're going from here, you know, this is the step change in evolution we may be looking at. But getting back to Vint, who apparently is unable to remember a specific date from 40 years ago when something important happened, there's an analogy. Apparently, now I was watching the Jon Stewart show the other day. So Jon Stewart has come back to the Daily Show one day a week. And I was watching his first show. And apparently he has discovered a new correlation of memory loss with taking depositions. It seems that during a deposition, people have the inability to precisely remember what was happening at a given time on a given date, even, you know, 30 or 40 years ago.
Well, I think that's a good voice, but, you know, however, you know, like that's a bit of a dig. You know, any individual that finds themselves in a legal situation should take the opportunity of the legal system to not screw up and say as little as possible is true.
So if you really don't remember
something really clearly, better not to repeat what you think you, because, you know, eyewitnesses, you know, are notoriously unreliable and so forth. And what you think exactly happened may not be correct. So anyways, I get his point, but right.
Well, as it was explained to me on multiple occasions before depositions, normal human conversation, somebody says, you know, do you remember this? You say, oh, I remember that. Sure.
Right.
Okay. That's different than having a specific memory of it. Right. Like, I remember we talked last week. What did we talk about? Oh, I don't remember the exact words. Where was his boat? It was on the water. I think he was in his boat. He's usually on his boat. It's just a very different thing in a legal matter to be very specifically focused on a real specific thing that happened than this general notion we have about truth and honesty and what took place, you know? And it's astonishing. I guess most people have not been in those situations. And if, as you ask more probing questions, all right, so which brings us to, and I'm going to try and stay out of politics. It brings us to I watched part of the a trial this week that had the district attorney who's prosecuting a case on the stand talking about, you know, her love affair or something like that. And, you know, trying to ask, you know, these people to remember, you know, in 2000 and, you know, way back when you were 18 years old, did your left shoe break? You know, I don't know, you know, I find that people get offended by these things. You know, they talk about how that's a bad witness, a witness that gets offended by your challenging them and asking them to explain, you know, how it is that they use money, why they have cash on their person. You know, well, I was brought up by my grandfather, who said you should always have enough cash in your person to last a month, because the culture I was brought in was one where people would, you know, burn your house and try and find you in the woods and kill you. So carry cash with you. I mean, it just brings up so many things about society and the differences in society between different people. And I there's something I love about the courtroom, and I love about emotionality. And it's, you know, we try to drive it out of things in some systems, in the logic systems, right? Remember, computers, they're all about logic. There's no emotion in them. And we talk about artificial intelligence, and there's no emotional aspect to these artificial pieces of intelligence. Where is the emotion? people try to put emotion into them by making equations for emotion. Say no.
Well, and people try to put logic into themselves by explaining why they did something. But if you really go all the way down, the answer most of the time is like, because I wanna. You know, I wouldn't have been trying to get myself into a position where I could justify doing what I basically wanted to do in the first place. So that whole human wanna, you know, is an amazingly powerful driver of like everything. Everything else, the reason we're doing what we wanted to do in the first place is just the justifications we've come up that'll give us the time, funding, resources, and stuff to do what we really wanted to do. Yeah, with the this whole internet thing, you know, as a kid, you know, my futurist, you know, sci-fi, you know, 60s and 70s childhood, you know, I wanted to live in a life where, in fact, what we got, you know, with everything from solar lithium boats to, you know, satellite communications and offshore and, you know, this digital world we've created here. So, you know, I spent most of my life helping build it, you know, and I can justify all those jobs and the money they paid or, you know, whatnot, but that's just part of it, you know. And this is, you know, when I talk inevitability curves, so much of that has to do with that. That, you know, another previous episode with Vince, I was trying to explain that mental feeling I have for it. You just start pushing against boundaries, and they're not because all the reasons that we philosophize and rationalize. It's just because people wanna less. You know, we just, this gestalt feeling of, no, we really don't like this. We don't want this. You start, sometimes we need to push up against that curved wall a little bit to build the resistance necessary to change it. Because if you're going in that direction, up that wall, you know, the wanna factor will come up with lots of good justifications to build systems and not do that anymore.
So it's an interesting thing you brought up in there. There's been a lot of study of decision-making. And one of the interesting things about decision-making is that most human decision-making, I'm not talking about reflex reactions here. I'm talking about higher level cognitive function decision-making. The statistics show, and I'm going to approximate because I don't remember exact numbers, something like 40% of the time in decision-making is justifying the decision you made. And, you know, less than 50% of it's actually making the decision. So there's some other stages in there. So the idea that when we're making decisions, there's some, you know, we figure it out and we've decided and we're good to go. It turns out, no, we think we've decided it and then we justify it to ourselves. And then we may change our mind because, you know, that wasn't a good enough justification, right? And,
oh, right.
And you know, the reason we did it. You know, it's not cause and effect. It's effect and, uh-oh, we better figure out a cause.
I find a great deal of peace in that, you know, and free will and everything else, right? You know, because if you get philosophical, you try to find the boundaries of the universe and possibilities, you realize there aren't any in quantum, like, whatever. But here we are, right? And you can't calculate all the information you can possibly consume and do anything with it usefully given the time you have, and here you are. So what do, right? You know, and the general we are built with, and I think we can tap into, you know, I'll tag my hippie roots on this. I think that there is a very Zen sort of, you know, in the center of yourself is what you want to do, right? And sure, we can't, don't get to do that all the time, but it drives everything. You know, in all of our daily lives, we've managed to find as much as we can that zone where we want to be. And this is a power, a force on demographic scales. When huge societies and huge populations like we have, you know, have the ability to express through some way in our capitalist world, you know, that's by buying things more, using things more, because, yeah, there's justification for it. It makes my business life better and I can, you know, play Pong with my friends, but basically I just want to. And that want to, you know, that general, and I think we can, we brush it aside, I think, as you were saying, you know, by trying to analyze it all down, or brush it aside as just being, you know, hippie nonsense, but it is a very, very real thing and it drives human behavior. And that human behavior drives the development of technology by the consumption of goods and services to do some specific goal, but it's just comfort, peace. It's what people want. You know, there's some resistance they're pushing up against your life. You can ease that and, you know, mountains move.
So bringing that into the logical world of Fred, there was some good studies done for a PhD at University of Southern California long ago, and that was the basis of a bunch of books on persuasion that are sold on airlines. That's very popular. But basically, it says that change comes from learning and acceptance. And learning comes from hearing and understanding, but acceptance comes from comfort with the message, relevant, and liking the idea.
Right.
So, yeah, it's about that zone of comfort, that stability that you have, the desire to not have radical change within your mind. And that's also related to how you decide that you like people and how you trust people. So we start to go back into this whole issue of how we establish trust, and liking is related to trust. And that then drives into the how the confidence experts take advantage of you and the influence operations. But before we drill into that, we're going to go on to the next subject.
And now a word from our sponsors.
Double header action tonight with two games.
In the pitch, a company presents in the hopes that you, the listening audience, will find them interesting enough to go the next step.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant Wednesday to you, wherever you may be.
Hello, my name is Michael DeSabato. I'm the CEO of Trust Architects. And there are some people out there that say, well, how can you architect trust? And I would say, you cannot afford not to architect trust. If you take a look at how zero trust is being implemented right now, it ultimately cannot work. It is strictly at a technical level. And as you can see from the recent news with Boeing and a number of other things, unlimited trust doesn't work either. What trust architecture does is create reasonable and prudent approaches and understandings and quantification of who you should trust, when you should trust them, how much you should trust them, and for how long. We have an interesting environment. There's been a lot of analysis on risk management. There's been a lot of analysis on human risk management. Technical security is a very mature field. Content controls, there's applications out there that can track and manage document controls, content controls, and we have zero trust. But none of these things are actually linked all together. There are very, very few companies that have their HR systems locked into their identity and access management system so that when somebody leaves or their role changes in the organization, they have a different level of trust, a different level of access automatically assigned to them. As a result, a lot of money is lost every year by over-trusting people and finding out that trust has been misplaced over time, or under-trusting people and putting in more rigid controls and processes than are necessary. We also have a problem sometimes with companies over-trusting their partners or under-trusting their partners and thereby creating problems in their manufacturing processes creating problems in the ongoing day-to-day operations. We're going to help you develop and adapt a reasonable and prudent trust architecture that's going to not only quantify what those losses could be, but help you limit those losses. We are in the process of developing a marketing and sales organization. We have everything in place we need to operate right now. Who are trust architects? Well, of course, me. I spent 20 years at Gartner as an analyst in mobile privacy and security. And I have a great deal of experience in developing policies and procedures within organizations that can integrate the management of risk and the management of trust across the entire organization. And we have Fred Cohen. He has a long, long career in cybersecurity. He wrote the first paper on computer viruses, and he continues to do significant research in that area and other areas as we move along. And the rest of our team are people like myself. We've had long storied careers in information technology, and we know what we're doing. This is not our first rodeo, and we understand what the needs and requirements are of our client base. I have several presentations planned on how exactly you would go and implement a trust architecture and what benefit that would be. We're supported by a really experienced sales team. A lot of those folks have come from the same companies that Fred and I have worked for over the years. These are people we know and trust and have proven track records. Thing is a tiered offering that starts out with the basics that every organization needs to understand, how they operate. And then in segments or modules that are targeted at individual departments, we will be looking at legal, human resources, some of the operational departments, manufacturing, document control, and content control, and how you would be interfacing with your partners. Execution, this is a SaaS Plus model. Our initial meetings with the organizations that we're going to be dealing with are more of a consultative nature to find out what their requirements are, what their existing state of their trust architecture, if they have one, what that is, and determine where there's room for improvement to them. The second and third phases of this drive more into defining what they need to change and then establishing metrics in our platform that will allow them to track what they're doing. This is top-down hierarchy. We start at the board and C-level executive committee level, and then move down through the operational departments. We have a lot of other tools in the pipeline that will help the audit committees determine where changes need to be made and to be integrated into what they're doing. And we also support compliance with various privacy laws, regulatory environments, and the kind of things that make operating a regulated industry in a regulated industry a little bit hassly. We're starting to recruit clients right now. There's a strong unmet need in this market. I've looked around, Fred's looked around. We can't find anybody who's actually creating a trust architecture, an architecture that you can look at and say, these are the costs. If I trust people too much, these are the costs. If I don't trust them enough, these are the areas where we need to modify our processes internally. These are the areas where we need to modify the contracts and business relationships we have externally. These are the promises we need to be making to our internal people, and very much important, as important, these are the promises we expect our external organizations and contacts to be making to us.
Matlack on the 0-1. Bobby hits a drive into the gap in the left center field. There she is. Just pull a double. Papers flying, everybody standing.
For more details on this pitch and to view their gee whiz, go to thecybershow.co and click on their listing.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
Next week on the Cyber Show, Ranger Bob becomes a sergeant. Vint toggles mechanical mechanisms to bootstrap. And Lighten lightens the cognitive load. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on the Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time and bow. A good time and bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.